5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all of your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments, so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Welcome back to iGenPolitics. This is a podcast that makes politics engaging and relevant for all generations. This is Victor Shi.
And I'm Jill Wine Banks, and I am virtually shaking in excitement and from having run upstairs to change pins. I was going to wear a January 6th Jill's pin, but the verdict came in minutes ago in the E. Jean Carroll trial, and I am now wearing a pink pussy hat and an octopus. And for anyone who's following that trial, you know why I have chosen those pins. One witness testified that he was like an octopus attacking her, and the other is his own statement about what he grabs. So it's a new meaning for the pink pussy hat.
Jill, your pins are amazing. Well, today, like you said, we were supposed to talk about January 6th, but this E. Jean Carroll verdict came down. I'm wondering, should we start off with that?
We can use our chit chat for that. Let's go right to Tim.
Sounds good.
Tim is here.
Let's go. Yeah, so we have Tim Heafy with us to talk about why January 6th is important today and going forward into the 2024 election. Tim Heafy was the chief investigative counsel for the United States House Select Committee on the January 6th attack. And before that, he served as United States Attorney for the Western District of Virginia. And he is now a white-collar criminal defense attorney at Wilkie Farr Gallagher in New York. Tim, it's so great to see you. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Sure, Victor and Jill. Really appreciate the invitation. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. So let's get right into the subject, which, you know, some people are going like, okay, January 6th, why does that matter today? You were part of a committee that did phenomenal work in investigating. That was the January 6th House Committee. And so let's review first what that was all about and walk our audience through what you and the lawyers and other investigators and the House members on the committee did to frame the events in a way that showed the American public what took place before January 6th, on January 6th, and after January 6th.
Yeah, Jill, you can't look at January 6th by itself in a vacuum. It really was part of a continuum of events, really, that stretches beyond 2020. There's been a disturbing rise of domestic violent extremist activity. Back to Charlottesville, where I live, where I served as U.S. attorney, and even before that, and it's continued after that. And one of the things the Select Committee wanted to do was to put January 6th in context. We found that what happened was a very specifically planned, multi-part plan to disrupt the joint session. And President Trump and his co-conspirators started out by trying to assert election fraud claims in the courts. They were unsuccessful. They then pivoted to putting pressure on state officials to try to take action to send fake elector certificates to Washington and conduct investigations of this non-existent fraud, pressure on the Justice Department, ultimately on Vice President Pence. And when none of that worked, the last prong in this plan was to send this angry, violent mob to the Capitol with the specific intent, we found, to disrupt the transfer of power. So a pretty shocking and harrowing set of facts that I think our report lays bare.
So there's been a lot of talk about who the audience was for these hearings. On one hand, I think it could be seen as the American people. On the other hand, it can be seen as the Department of Justice. Was there an intended audience here, and who was it?
No, Victor, I mean, I think we went into this. I went into this thinking, look, about a third of America already believed that President Trump was a danger to democracy. Another third of America will always believe in him and would see our effort as not credible. So therefore, there's kind of a middle third of people in this country that I think are remain persuadable or open-minded about him and the broader issues that we identified. And I personally kind of looked at that middle third as our core audience. I think the Department of Justice became a core audience. I think it's pretty clear that it wasn't until we started to find some facts and those facts were presented at hearings and were reported that it kind of forced them to take a look at some of those issues as possible crimes. So I think we were ahead of them and maybe put some pressure on them by finding some facts that suggest a violation of federal criminal statutes.
It's really interesting that you did the one-third, because I think statistics now show that we are no longer really a two-party country. A third are and a third are, but the middle third are lean one way or the other, but they aren't really affiliated. And I think it's really important both in campaigning and in persuading and showing to keep that in mind, that there is a third of the country that is persuadable, that can be subject to evidence that's gathered and presented in a cogent way. So let's talk about the evidence gathering process that you used and who you work closely with in that, in terms of, you know, and did you coordinate with the Department of Justice? Because a lot of people think that it was sort of like, well, if you do it, then they don't have to, or if they do it, you don't, you know, let's talk about all of that. How you got it and, you know, what role did the Justice Department play? What role did the FBI play? What role did your own investigative team play?
Yeah, Joe, it was pretty independent. We had conversations with DOJ. We wanted information from them because they had already charged a lot of people with crimes, and we were hopeful that we would get access to those people, or at least what they said, as we tried to put together who was responsible for putting the riot together. They were very resistant to share information with us. They traditionally don't share information about ongoing investigations with Congress. So they wanted information from us. They asked for all of our transcripts and access to what we were finding, but they weren't willing to share that with us. And I think the Attorney General was also very concerned about ensuring that the department was not seen as politically motivated. Mm-hmm. And coordination with a congressional committee might have given the impression that they were somehow motivated by politics or partisan. So there was really not any coordination. There was some communication with the department and frankly with the Fulton County investigators in Georgia. They similarly were looking at some of the same facts as we were. But we conducted our own investigation. We hired a lot of investigative counsel. We hired some experts to look at particular issues with which they were previously familiar. So we kind of created from scratch an investigative team, about 55 employees, about half of which were lawyers. We ended up hiring 14 former federal prosecutors, not because we were trying to make a criminal case, but because the lawyers with experience that's relevant, asking questions, devouring large amounts of information, deciding what's relevant, and then thinking about a presentation, are people that honed that skill largely in the criminal justice world. So we ended up with a lot of former AUSAs who were part of our team. And we have five different investigative teams, each of which was sort of focused on a subset of the investigation.
Can you describe two things for me? One, the five different teams, because I think that is very interesting. But I also want to explore, before you get to that, you said that they weren't willing to share with you. And I think it's important. I can understand why that is with an ongoing investigation and the secrecy of grand jury testimony and how the Department of Justice operates as to why they would not, during the pendency of an investigation, share. But I think a lot of people in our audience will not understand that and will think that it's something evil. Did you consider it evil or understandable?
Don't consider it evil, and it's frankly, you know, consistent with their normal approach, right? When they're developing evidence, and let's say they have a cooperating witness who's a member of the Proud Boys who has told them what he did and what others did, if that person then gives a statement to us, there will inevitably be some potentially small inconsistencies. The more times a witness tells a story, the more material there is for potential impeachment or cross-examination of that witness. So the department, and I was there myself and worked there for years, just wants to keep its evidence as pristine and unaffected by other interviews or other information as possible. And again, part of this is congressional oversight. They're willing to submit information to Congress, but not investigative information. That has been the DOJ policy. It goes back to a memo about the Lois Lerner case that goes back to the 1980s, and it's enshrined in this document that the department routinely cites when they get requests from Congress, and they did that with us. So there are good reasons, institutional reasons for that. Now, the five teams, like our scope, Jill, was really broad. It was investigate the facts and circumstances surrounding the attack on the Capitol. We had to kind of put our hands around that and try to come up with some kind of structure. So we came up with this sort of five interlocking teams. Two of them were what happened at the Capitol. There was the blue team and the red team, either side of the fence, so to speak, at the Capitol. The blue team was focused on law enforcement and military. What information did they have in advance? How did they manage the event in real time? The National Guard deployment, the interagency law enforcement cooperation. Red was focused on the organization of the riot, right? The Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers. How much organization was there? How much did these groups and individuals work together? Red, because it's so many of them in the crowd, were sort of MAGA supporters. We zoomed out from either side of the fence to the really important contexts in which the riot occurred, and that was where the purple and the gold teams came into play. Purple goes back to what I was saying at the very beginning of our conversation. The rise in domestic violent extremism writ large, reaching back historically, there were events at state capitals over the course of the year, the sort of broader pattern that we're fortunately experiencing in America. That was the focus of the purple team, with an addition of social media and how electronic sources are used to recruit and organize those groups. And then the gold team was really focused on the election. So many people, as you know, were at the Capitol, were focused on this false narrative that the election was stolen. So the gold team developed this kind of political coup, the multi-part plan that we ultimately described. A lot of that was from the gold team because they were focused on this narrative of election fraud. And finally, the green team was funding streams, like who was paying for it. We wanted to figure out whether there were, you know, domestic or international wealthy individuals or organizations that were paying for some of this activity. All of those teams were distinct, a senior investigative counsel and some people that were assigned to each, but they had to work closely together. So all the team leads and I would meet every Monday morning and talk about what we've learned, talk about where we're going, ensuring that we were coordinated as we pursue the investigation.
I just want to comment that you mentioned that this goes back to the 80s, the policy of the not sharing the information, but actually this was an issue during Watergate in the early 70s, where you had simultaneous investigation by the special prosecutor and by the special committee under Senator Ervin. And you had the exact issue that you raised, which is witnesses would come in and talk to us, and then they would go and testify. And if there was any slight deviation in testimony, you run into that impeachment issue. And it's inevitable that when you're telling the truth, it's going to deviate as you remember different issues, or you use different phraseology, which can be interpreted differently. So it's a really important point for people to know. And like you, we were divided. You know, everybody thinks that Watergate was just the case I was on, which was the obstruction of justice. And it wasn't. I mean, there was a campaign contributions task force. There was a plumbers task force, a dirty tricks task force, because there were so many different areas of criminal activity that we needed to focus into the different crimes that were committed. So it seems in ways similar. And now we're waiting to see. We know what happened with your committee. Now we're waiting to see what happens with the special counsel and with Fannie Willis in Georgia and with everybody else that's involved in looking criminally and civilly at the different aspects of activity before, during, and after January 6th.
Yes, so, I think criminal charges are coming, right? We recommended to the Attorney General that he evaluate violations of four separate criminal statutes. I think he actually has the ability to get information beyond what the committee got, right? They have the ability very quickly to litigate privilege assertions, and they've been very successful thus far in convincing the chief judge of the DC District Court and then ultimately the DC Circuit to overrule witnesses' privilege assertions. So they're getting some people to answer questions that they did not include us. I think that it's only going to make the case of President Trump's specific intent to disrupt the joint session even stronger. We built sort of a wall around several of those holes of privilege assertion. I think we essentially got the core story, but now those holes are going to be filled, and I think it's only going to make the wall stronger. So I expect, just having looked at this hard for a year and a half, that the Department of Justice will bring criminal charges. I think Fani Willis and the Fulton County DA will similarly bring criminal charges based on this conspiratorial conduct in the joint session.
So we definitely want to get to the Department of Justice's response, or hopefully eventual response to this. But I want to go back to the process that you just laid out, because that was fascinating. You mentioned just kind of social media and the footage that you all had. I mean, can you talk more about that process of choosing the footage to show and what footage ended up not being shown and kind of how you made that determination?
Yeah, Victor, it's a blessing and a curse as an investigator to have an event that was documented to that degree. I mean, there was so much material that was live streamed from participants in the riot, body cams of police officers. The Capitol complex has over 800 different cameras, internal and external. All of that footage is available to us. And you're looking, as you review all of that, for sort of seminal events, right? For instances that are important or demonstrate larger patterns. And somebody had to go through all of that with a big picture sense of what is important or what are the larger patterns that we're developing. So it was useful, and we ended up getting a lot of really important video and audio that we used in our hearings that were important in, as we examined witnesses. But there was just a hell of a lot of it that, while it was interesting and while it was useful, it did not ultimately make it into the report or make it into a hearing, because it was redundant or it didn't necessarily advance our understanding of it.
So
we had great cooperation from the Capitol. Yeah, go ahead, Victor.
Oh, I was going to ask, I mean, given all of that footage and how hard it was to compile all that footage, I mean, what do you make of Kevin McCarthy's decision to release 41,000 exclusive hours of footage to Tucker Carlson?
Yeah, so I was just about to say, we had that Capitol Police footage and body cam footage with the agreement that before we used any of it publicly, we would have a conversation with the Capitol Police, with the Metropolitan Police, because they were very concerned that the location of those 800 and some cameras is in the future creates a security risk. So they wanted to minimize the use of it, and they wanted to maybe zoom in on an image or obscure other things. There was also the issue of evacuation routes for the vice president and others that the video depicted. They were concerned about that information getting out and being an ongoing security concern, because this, you know, we have to be careful that this doesn't happen again. And the release of that footage makes it easier for people to potentially, you know, commit future attacks on the Capitol armed with that information. So I think it's hugely irresponsible for the new speaker to give all that footage without any such understanding to a news outlet. It's also been irresponsibly used, right? Tucker Carlson has used it selectively and very misleadingly. Right? He shows footage of Capitol Police officers walking next to the QAnon shaman, for example, and suggests that they're escorting rioters. That's ridiculous. What they're doing is de-escalating and doing good police work to try to get people to leave the Capitol, because they can't put their hands on and arrest the thousands of people that were inside the building because they were outmanned. So the sort of selective clips and use of it to forward this false narrative is also terribly irresponsible, predictable and irresponsible. So with real strong negative reaction to the speaker's decision to release that footage.
Well, in addition to the negatives you've pointed out, it seems to me that the unfairness of giving it exclusively to one very biased news source is also equally horrible. That if you're going to do that, despite the danger of releasing the camera locations, et cetera, you have to give it to everybody. You can't pick Tucker Carlson. But okay, so let's look at, you also, besides this very riveting footage, you had testimony from a wide range of witnesses, you know, Capitol Police and just many, many others. You had legal scholars, you had government officials, you had former aides to the president. Was there two questions, I guess, one or two witnesses that you really wanted to question that you didn't get, that you think that probably justice will get? And was there any one or two that you think were so compelling that they really added to the public narrative that we as American citizens got?
Let me take the last question first. I think Attorney General Barr, Pat Cipollone, and Cassidy Hutchinson, if I had to sort of pick witnesses that were most important to our work, it was them, right? They're all very close to the president. They all worked hand in glove with him for years before this. So they were loyal to the president. They were not doing this because they had some political axe to grind.
Right.
They were all adults in the room and stood up and did the right thing or tried to convince him to do the right thing at the time. Cassidy was particularly important because she was also, you know, right in the center of working with Mark Meadows, a person who would not talk to us. Her ability to share with us a lot of conversations in which he participated sort of was one of those bricks around the hole that I was talking about before that was tremendously important. If there are people that we didn't hear from that I would have liked to, the two that I would say I would put first on the list are Mark Meadows and Dan Scavino. Both of them were two of the very closest people to the president on the day of the riot and around that time. Meadows was centrally involved in the multi-part plan to disrupt the joint session, would say whatever he thought the audience wanted to hear, right? Some people told us, Meadows said, yeah, the president's coming around, we're gonna get him to acknowledge this defeat. And then he would tell other people and often text other people, we're keeping up the good fight and this isn't over yet. So he was two-faced and never consistent. But what he saw and heard and did was central. And Dan Scavino was the president's pipeline to the outside world. He controlled the president's media feed. He often was getting tweets dictated and was reviewing tweets for the president. He was with them at all times. So the two of them would have given us even more of a bird's eye view into President Trump's state of mind all the way up to and on January 6th. And I hope that justice gets them. I know that they've been subpoenaed. I don't know. They might have Fifth Amendment privileges. I don't know if DOJ will get them, but they're justifiably high on Jack Smith's list.
And speaking of Jack Smith or the Justice Department, and you've talked about some of the cooperation and some of the non-cooperation with them, but it's viewed that you really put together the January 6th committee, put together a very quick investigation and report. And that it's taking DOJ a really long time. Can you comment about the pace of your work versus the pace of DOJ?
Yeah, I will say that it's clear to me that they got a late start, that they were focused initially on what I call the blue collar cases, the people that were violent at the Capitol. That took up a lot of space and is still the largest criminal investigation in the history of the department. I also think there was a reticence to dive into this political world. I think the Attorney General and others, I think, were concerned about the department not getting dragged into what was a political dispute. And it wasn't until our evidence showed this isn't just a political dispute, this is a political coup, right? A potentially an attack on democracy that involved people at the highest levels of government, that they kind of realized, okay, we can't avoid this investigation, we have to look into it. Now, I think they've caught up and they've gone beyond where we were. They're just doing their homework. Jill, you know this from your time in government as well. Look, if you're going to bring a case of this magnitude, you have to be completely thorough. You have to give absolutely every possible source of relevant information. You have to reach out to him or her to try to get that information. It is a big deal, and it should be a big deal that only comes about after a very thorough, very meticulous investigation. So I think they're marching through that. I think they're close to the end, given some of the people that they have recently gotten before the grand jury. But it just takes a while to get all of that evidence and have it all be part of the consideration before decisions.
So, Tim, it's so interesting because on the hashtag Sisters-in-Law podcast, we discussed this. And I talked about, you know, not only how long it takes to get all your ducks in a row and to make sure you've got all the exculpatory evidence as well as all the incriminating evidence, and that the standard may be higher when you're investigating a former president. And there was at least one person who said, that's terrible. That's against the Constitution to have a higher standard. But it's a reality that when you're prosecuting, you want to be sure you can convict. And it's not a question of that it's a different standard. It's a, can I convict? Is there going to be a jury that's going to find that I have proved this beyond a reasonable doubt, knowing that doubt will be greater on behalf of someone like a former president? And so it's just a reality.
If you're going to swing at the king, then you better knock him out, right? Like you got to be ready to come hard if you're going to come at all, and that's what they're
doing. Right.
So I'm wondering what you make of Jack Smith's pace so far, and whether or not you think there's a risk that his expansion of the investigation into fake electors, plus, I guess, investigating wherever facts lead, including fundraising on the lie of fraud, will run out the clock before the primaries.
Victor, I think all of that stuff is part of it. I think the fundraising stuff is crucial. I think a lot of what motivated this attack on the Capitol is a fraud scheme. You look at President Trump's whole life, it's been a series of grifts, really. And this fundraising on the Stop the Steal narrative was so successful. They raised $250 million after the election was called for President Biden and before the inauguration, just on this Stop the Steal narrative. And he continues to raise money today on that same narrative. So false statements in political fundraising, texts and emails that were incessantly going out, saying this was going to some election defense fund, which was not true, making all these false claims. That sounds to me like mail or wire fraud, and therefore is a very viable theory and a really important part of the broader context if you're going to understand these events. The fake electors, right? Those are false statements. Those are 1001 violations, 18 U.S.C. section 1001, knowing submission to Congress of a document that purports to be official, like the official slate from the state. That's a crime and a crucial part of the context. So I don't see him straying beyond the core narrative. I think these are all part and parcel to what is really a complicated pattern of activity, all of which ends at the Capitol on January 6th.
Yeah. And so we started off the episode by talking about the divide in our nation, the third of people who support Trump, the third of people in the middle, the third of people on the left. But do you feel like the January 6th hearings reached any of that third that supports Trump? And if not, do you think it's possible to get those facts in them at this point?
Yeah, it's a good question. I don't know the answer to that. I mean, a lot of America watched. Yeah. How much of America had their minds changed is really hard to tell. Look, I believe that facts matter, we're not beyond that in this country. The problem, Victor, is that a lot of people in this country no longer believe in the sources of those facts that most of us believe in. They don't believe in the legitimacy of government. They don't believe in the court. They don't believe in the media, for example. They don't believe in higher education or science, right? There's a fundamental cynicism about the sources of information. So what I look at and see plainly, hey, this election, President Biden won this election. There's just no factual dispute about that. They question that conclusion because they question the messengers or the fact gatherers. And that, to me, is the fundamental divide in America. It's those who believe in systems and the social, you know, compact, and those that have lost faith in those institutions and no longer believe in it. That is a really dangerous thing that if we don't talk about and get a handle on, we're going to face, you know, repeats of this in the future.
I'd expand on that a little bit by saying that there's also the people who do believe in the system, at least on an academic level, but refuse to accept facts and who are acting. And I'm talking about members of Congress who voted not guilty despite this overwhelming evidence. You could say, I don't want to impeach him for this. You cannot say he was not guilty of what the evidence clearly showed. And that is a danger to democracy as much. But let's maybe wrap up this segment about this topic just by talking about legislation that could result from your report. And I mean, it's, I actually, let's see, I got my copy here.
Oh yeah, your report there.
And guys, if you haven't seen it, it's big, it's heavy.
So, in
terms of legislation, some has passed, most is just sort of sitting there doing nothing. And so let's talk about what those takeaways are.
So the one that passed is the Electoral Count Act, right? That Congress has, and this was Ms. Cheney and Ms. Lofgren, two of our members, that in a bipartisan way co-sponsored a change, or I won't really call it a radical change, but more of a clarification of the Electoral Count Act, what the role of the vice president is, the role of the states. It sort of makes clear what the joint certification process is all about. If there was any uncertainty that the president tried to suggest that there was, it has now been eliminated by the responsible clarification of that statute. There are other things that we haven't done yet, and Jill, you're right. I think one of the big ones is the way in which we assess, disseminate, and operationalize information about domestic terrorism, domestic violent extremism. Mm-hmm. We keep getting this wrong. I did a big report about the Charlottesville events, and similarly, that was not an intelligence failure or a resource failure. It was really clear in advance, based on the intel, that there were people coming that were dangerous, that were bent on violence. Similar, January 6th was not an intelligence failure or a resource failure. It was a failure to appreciate the real threat. And why that is, there's a lot of reasons for that. We don't share information among agencies. The FBI, I think, puts undue restrictions based on First Amendment or free association concerns. They won't take any action unless a specific piece of open source information is sufficiently specific and credible to open a preliminary investigation. So they don't do anything prophylactic, you know, knock on the door and ask someone who's on Facebook with an AK-15 saying this is 1776. They don't do anything with that information unless it rises to the level of specificity to be a threat. That's a problem. And look, some of it is straight up racism, right? I think it's the way that law enforcement assesses danger is infected by implicit bias, right? You look at the difference between the way we prepared for the George Floyd protests in the summer of 2020 a very heavy approach versus if it's a bunch of white guys that are talking about, you know, storming the Capitol, we are, you know, sort of curiously and surprisingly passive when it comes to that. So I think we got to talk about implicit bias in law enforcement and how we assess danger and whether race infects that. All of these things are really important. They need to be talked about in Congress. They need to be talked about within these agencies. I'm hopeful that our report planted some of those seeds, and our recommendations, which are sort of more of an issue spot, will prompt some of that in discussion.
Absolutely. I really hope. I mean, I don't know if I have much hope left in this Congress, but hopefully the next Congress we elect will take up some of those recommendations because they're so important. But let's talk about some other accountability and shift gears to some other news regarding January 6th. Most notably, last week, there was news that four members of the Proud Boys were found guilty of seditious conspiracy, including one who was not at the Capitol or even in D.C. A few months later, members of the Oath Keepers were also found guilty of seditious conspiracy. So do you think this opens the door to successfully charging Trump with seditious conspiracy, possibly?
I think the key for seditious conspiracy, Victor, is intent to use violence. So we have evidence that Stuart Rhodes and the Oath Keepers, Enrique Terrio and the Proud Boys specifically intended to violently disrupt the lawful function of government. That's seditious conspiracy. Yeah. In order for President Trump to be charged with seditious conspiracy, there needs to be evidence that he too specifically intended violence. What we found was that lots of evidence that he specifically intended to obstruct, interfere with, or impede the joint session by sending that, you know, firing up that angry mob, sending them to the Capitol and then not doing anything as they were violently protesting. But did he intend violence? Is there evidence of his intent to use violence? That's a much higher standard. I'm not sure. I'm sure that they're looking at that. We recommend in our report that that is a charge that they should evaluate. I can't say that we found direct evidence of the president's intent that violence be used. I think part of the conspiracy hoped that just the presence of all of those people would put pressure on the vice president and members of Congress to essentially not go forward with the joint session. Whether they intended a riot, they certainly knew it was possible because of the intelligence, but did they intend it? I don't know. It's a charge on the table. I think it's less likely seditious conspiracy than obstruction of an official proceeding. That's likely the lead charge that the special counsel is evaluating.
So there's, of course, news now that Mike Pence testified before the special counsel, yeah, and that Jack Smith actually was there during his testimony, which he, of course, it would be impossible for the special counsel to be present every time a witness testifies at their grand jury. Yeah. But what do you make of that? Do you think that's an indication that things are moving fast in the Jack Smith investigation? Do you think that that's the last witness, or are we in for more prolonged issues?
I think the good question, Jill, I think that all of the answer to all those questions is likely yes. The playbook is that you sort of build up to the most important witnesses. Right. You want to be as smart as possible when you interview arguably the central witness in this whole thing, other than President Trump, is the vice president. So you don't want to do that until you're confident you have as much of the story and you're prepared for that. We didn't get a final response from the vice president until very close to the end of our discussions with him. I doubt that his grand jury testimony created anything really new in terms of direction of the investigation. We knew a lot already about his position on his authority, his direct communications with the president. He had spoken publicly and written about that. So I'm not sure that there were any new bombshell facts. There's maybe some context and some clarification, but the fact that it's from him, the fact that it is direct from the vice president, who was 40 feet at one moment from rioters inside the Capitol, right? His lived experience as a victim on January 6th, his direct communications with the president when the president called him, as the awful word Jill mentioned earlier, on the phone that morning, like getting his account of that, even though we kind of knew what he was going to say, is really important. So I do think it's important. I do think it matters a lot. I do think it suggests that they're close to the end. If they're talking to the vice president, putting him in the grand jury, there can't be many more, sort of big picture witnesses left to go. I think it suggests they're getting close. I think this summer or fall at the latest is when a charging decision is made. They want to do it before the beginning of the primary season in early 24.
Yeah. One of the hardest things for prosecutors is knowing when to stop, when enough is enough. Because you can, in any of these, I started in organized crime, but even in Watergate, you could investigate forever because there was so much going on. But at some point you have to say, okay, this is a good case. I'm going to bring this. I can add another case later if I need to, but at least I have to get going because otherwise justice delayed becomes justice denied. And so
you can also know from your organized crime work that what happens is, let's say they bring a case against five people. Two or three of them may decide, I don't want to go to jail for President Trump. I'm gonna cooperate, right? You often get indictment cooperation information. Cases get stronger, and then there's a superseding indictment and additional charges
for
people are added. I wouldn't be shocked here if the indictment is a conspiracy, and some of those conspirators, when they're finally facing a federal judge charged with crimes, may decide to not assert a Fifth Amendment privilege, but actually cooperate and make the case even stronger.
Right.
So this might be a pretty big question, but how do we prevent another January 6th from happening?
Big question. Look, to me, Victor, this whole episode showed me that democracy is sort of earned, not given, that we all have to realize that it comes down to people doing the right thing. And if everybody in America actively participated in our democracy, I think it would be stronger. I think what happens, going back to that point about cynicism, is that a lot of people, their cynicism takes the form of apathy and lack of participation. So they sort of sit back and they don't vote or they don't pay close enough attention. And that gives more power to people that have really that more cynical view. I think if everybody in America were to actively participate in their community, and to care about big issues, I think we would have a better, more functional democracy. So my hope is that part of the way we prevent another attack on the Capitol is that this is a wake-up call for a lot of people, hey, I got to do my part, right? I've got to pay attention. I've got to vote. I've got to engage. And that it gets more people off their couch or off the sidelines, right? President Obama often says, you know, for every one of these steps backward, it unleashes a more powerful response. You look at Parkland and the shooting and the activism that unleashed, or the Me Too movement, and right when there are these awful things that happen, there's a potential for, in response to that, for people to get engaged. I hope that that's what happens, that more and more people plug in. The democracy has to be something that we earn day to day.
It's really a remarkable set of facts that have existed, and it all depends on getting conflicting ideologies or conflicting slates of facts. And really, there is no such thing as conflicting slates of facts. There's real facts and fake news, alternative facts. And I'm hoping that we can find a way to get through to people. But for a last question, I want to ask you, I mean, having been part of one of the most exciting things of the last, you know, quarter century, how does it feel to then transition to private practice? Are you missing all the excitement of being daily in the news?
Yes. It was hard. It was grueling. I live in Charlottesville. I was away from my family for a long time. It was one of those experiences that was so completely consuming that even when I was home, I was kind of distracted. I feel fortunate to have had a chance to do it. And yeah, I absolutely miss, you know, being at the center of a really important investigation. That said, I'm hopeful that it translates to continue to do important investigative work in private practice, right? I want to be one of those lawyers that when there is a crisis of some kind in a community, in a company, in a university, whatever it is, I can, you know, help sort out what happened, who's responsible, and try to leave the place better than it was before. That's the kind of practice that I'm aspire to build at Wilkie Farr, where I work now. And I hope, Jill, that it gives me, you know, an opportunity to continue to do that kind of good work in different settings.
I wish you the best. Yeah. Hope that that's true.
Thank you.
So we often end by asking our guests their advice for young people. But in my understanding, it appears that law school decisions have come down. People are making decisions to go to law school. What is your advice to law school students as they enter their 1L years and their journey into law?
Yeah, so I just finished teaching a class at the law school at UVA called Law and Riots. It's about the intersection of free speech and public safety and how hard it is to protect both. So I have had this conversation with my students at UVA. Look, I think the law is a tool. I went to law school because I wanted to have a skill that I could use to do justice. It sounds sort of hokey and high-minded, but when you have something in your head that gives you the ability to use a system that is there to make sure that the world is fair, that there's order, that there's justice, man, take advantage of that. So my advice to law students is find a way to use that considerable opportunity for good. Do whatever it is that's important to you, whether it's your full-time job or something you do as a pro bono matter or something you do for your friends and family, use that skill to make the world a more fair and just and humane place. There are lots of ways to do that, big and small. You don't have to work on something like the Select Committee to do that. You can do that in your own life. So I hope law students feel that privilege, but with that privilege comes responsibility.
You know, you quoted President Obama before, and right after he left the presidency, he spoke at the Economic Club of Chicago. And in answer to one question, he said, "The best advice I have is to be informed and be involved." And I think that's true for not just law students, it's college graduates, it's high school graduates, it's everyone. You have to be informed. And that means getting your news from reliable sources or multiple sources and deciding which one you really actually think is true. So
totally
I hope that that's what your students will learn from you as well. And we thank you for being with us today. It's been a great conversation. Last question, though, is just to remind everyone why January 6th matters today. Why did we spend time talking about it?
Yeah, it matters because it almost worked. You know, I kind of went into this thing. A lot of angry people, law enforcement was there. No, it was close to being. When you step back and think, we almost had a literal an interruption in the peaceful transfer of power, mm-hmm. bedrock principle of this country. That's kind of scary. But for the action, first of all, the bravery of the Capitol Police officers that defended, physically defended members of Congress and everyone at the Capitol, and the courage of people like Mike Pence, like Raffensperger, like Bill Barr, right, that did the right thing, even if it was against their personal interest. This could have been different. So if nothing else, hopefully we rang the bell that, again, this almost worked. We have to do better in the future, or it could be successful the next time. I hope that going back to our discussion of recommendations and issues that we flag, it's less likely to happen in the future. I don't know. I think a lot can happen between now and January 6th of 2025. I'm hopeful that the arc of justice continues to bend toward justice and we're on the two steps forward phase.
Again, thank you, Tim.
Thank you so much. Yes, thank you for all that you do, and thank you for coming on today. That was such an interesting episode, Jill. And I know we want to get into the news that just broke before we went live. Do you want to walk our audience through it? I mean, it's so exciting. Sure. And your pins have never been more spot on than today, I feel like.
I felt it was inevitable. Well, I did take notes as the jury verdict was being read. And so let me be factual about this.
Yes.
The jury had to answer a series of questions. And I will not be able to explain one of their answers. The first answer was, do you find that he is liable for rape? And the jury said, no. Then they said, but he is liable, in answer to question two, for sexual abuse. And based on the testimony, I cannot tell you why you could find sexual abuse, but not the rape. She testified. She had two witnesses corroborate that it happened. She had two other witnesses who said, this is what he did to me. You had his own voice saying, this is what I do to women. And all three of them who testified that he did it to them followed. But anyway, yes to sexual abuse. And was she injured by that? Yes. $2 million worth of injury from that sexual abuse. That's question four. Question five, was this willful and reckless? Yes. $20,000. Defamatory? Yes. False? Yes. As by clear and convincing evidence? Yes. Then we go to eight, which is, was there actual malice? Yes. Injury by the defamation? Yes. $1 million for reputation repair. I'm sorry, for other than reputation repair from the defamation. 1.7 from reputation repair, and it was actual malice, and $280,000 for punitive damages for that, leading to a total of $5 million.
Yeah.
$5 million. 1, 2, 1, 1, 7, 280, and 20. So you put it all together, and keep in mind that the jury verdict was reached in less than 3 hours.
3 hours. Yeah.
That means there was unanimous agreement from the very beginning. The evidence was clear and convincing. I hope it will inspire some of the other women who have been assaulted by him and the many who have been defamed by him to sue him. There is a way forward. There is a way to do this.
There is a way forward.
And the law works.
And hopefully it goes even beyond those women and shows every single person who has ever faced sexual assault or abuse that they can come forward and speak their truth and get their day in court and get justice. And that's kind of this whole process is so important, because we have this traditional notion where people are scared to confront power and help their abusers, but today is sort of a vindication that, you know, it is possible to go in court and get what you want and that justice. So I really hope, like you said, it inspires other women to do the same.
And not just women, but anybody who
has. Not just women, anyone,
defamed or sexually assaulted. If you remember, we had on this show a young man who had been sexually assaulted by his boss. And that's almost even harder than for a woman to come forward. So it's tough. And I mean, on the other hand, anyone watching this will see how she was bullied during the cross-examination. I think personally that that helped her in a sense, because a jury gets angry when they see someone being abused. And she was abused by Tacopina. So this was good. And it does show in the same way that the Proud Boys conviction of someone who wasn't in Washington can be guilty, shows that there is a path forward against those who led and planned and strategized for this, including the Willard Hotel War Room people. So, and the Oval Office occupant. So I think we've learned a lot in the last few days. What a week this has been. It's amazing.
And it's only Tuesday. And I've been reading the comments that we've been getting in. People have been saying we should get on people like Lisa Rubin, maybe even Ejin Knoll herself or her lawyers. So we'll try to get that content to you in the coming weeks, because this is such an important case, and no one should underestimate just how important it is. But in the remaining time that we have left, should we talk about,
Lisa Rubin has been amazing in covering this case, and in her commentary has been just brilliant. And of course, Roberta Kaplan did an amazing job in her presentation and her willingness to take this on. It's not that easy to take on even a criminal president. So this was amazing. And I think we should try, and hopefully those people are listening to us and they will be willing to join us.
Yes, absolutely. Well, in the remaining time that we have left, last Monday was College Commitment Day. Jill, I know you're speaking to the University of Illinois this weekend. Your parting advice for graduates, but maybe we can talk about advice for students who are either graduating high school or college, and some of the advice you have and maybe we have for those students.
Oh, I hate to give away my whole speech before I give it. And it's really hard not to fall into cliches at this moment.
Yes.
It's very easy to do that. And I guess I will talk more generally about, I don't think anyone will remember what I say, in the same way that I have no idea what anyone said at any of my commencements. And I'm not even sure I remember who spoke at my commencement, but there is something to be said about how you make people feel. And I hope that I can inspire people. And I didn't think of this until just now, but I just got birthday wishes from a 9-year-old. And I don't think I've shared this with you yet, Victor. I read this note and I almost was reduced to tears. And I just want to say she listens to BBC Outlook, which is where she heard me. And she started the letter, an email through my website. And it wasn't until well into it that she said, "And I'm 9 years old." And I was like shocked and amazed. And I think in the same way that I was inspired by people I saw speak on my college campus, Nancy Haunchman Dickerson being one of them, and by some of my professors, Professor Carey at the University of Illinois, Professor Rosenberg at law school, Professor Nagel at the University of Illinois, I hope that maybe students will listen and remember at least being inspired by the person that spoke to them, even if they don't remember the word they say. And to go for it. If you want to do something, do it. If I can do it, so can you. I was an ordinary, average person and nothing particular. And my parents somehow raised me to think I could do it. And thank you, parents. I hope your parents are doing the same for you. And if not, I hope you will take from me, who is old enough to be your grandmother, you can do it and you have to try.
Yes, no, that is so true. And I don't have that much advice for high students, but I will say, as I'm graduating next year, I've been thinking about, you know, my college experience so far, and it's just kind of, you'll never get this moment again. I mean, college is so unique. Yeah. It is such an amazing moment to learn new things, meet new people, go to different events. I mean, you're just constantly kind of learning new things, and take advantage of that. And if you're going into college, congratulations. If you're thinking of, you know, what you want to do with the next 4 years, just try to soak it all in. And I'm not looking forward to the day that I graduate, because I know I'm going to have to enter the real world. But just in the remaining year that I have left, it's, I think the lesson has been just soak in all of it, because there's so much in college.
There is, and you should be open to changing where you started. I started in occupational therapy. And I moved on to journalism and then on to law. And then after practicing law, into business and then into education and now onto television. I mean, it's, life is not linear, and you just have to be available for the opportunities and willing to take a risk, calculated risk. You don't want to do stupid things. You don't want to jump without a parachute, but you know, there are ways to take expansion and ideas and move forward. So that's, I think, what my advice would be. And, you know, you and I have talked about little details of networking, how important that is.
Yes, yes.
Making people feel comfortable by making them talk about themselves. That's the best way to meet people and to also learn. But learning, I think you hit it, you know, learning. That's, you know, you'll never have a chance to take a course in Russian literature again. You know, it's just do it. It's fascinating. Or
there are so many things that we could talk about that, I mean, even kind of school doesn't teach you things like networking, how to have those conversations. That can be its own episode, I feel like.
Okay, maybe we'll do one of those episodes. We can try it. So thank you, Victor, for this conversation. And I hope I can hone it down somehow to give wise advice without sounding silly.
Well, hopefully your graduation speech is recorded, so we can all watch it later. But I know for anyone in our audience, feel free to kind of drop your advice for graduating high schoolers or college students. We'll take a read, and maybe you can inspire Jill to think of or include one of your pieces of advice.
Better yet, tweet me at Jill Winebanks and tell me what I should say, because I'm still writing and I am open to anything that you either would like to hear if you were in the graduating class, or that you heard at your own graduation that has stayed with you. That would be really great if I could get that input. Thank you all for cooperating with that.
Yes, tweet to Jill Winebanks, and we look forward to hearing from you. And thank you all for watching this episode of iGen Politics with Tim Heafy. We hope we will see you next week for another episode of iGen Politics. Be sure to like and subscribe right here on youtube.com/politicon if you're watching, so you don't miss an episode. Or if you're listening, be sure to subscribe and leave us a rating so you don't miss our episodes every Wednesday. Again, thank you for watching or listening, and we will see you next week.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com, RiteRug.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring. Right.